I'm Afshendra Tansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE under the shadow of US war on Iran, where around 1,280 years ago today saw the Abbasid Revolution. Today, as the genocide continues in Palestine, the fate of the region appeared to be decided on Wednesday in Washington. All that as Burkina Faso's Ibrahim Traore won't be at today's African Union Leaders Summit in Ethiopia, and redundant NATO-US vassal state personnel gather in a Munich hotel to rally the Epstein class and advance doomed plans to destroy Russia and China. Peace through dialogue is what the failing, but still dangerous, 62nd Munich Security Conference calls it. Given that Western European powers actually refuse dialogue with Russia, perhaps Rubio and the rest would be better off at tonight's Valentine's Carnival in Venice instead of the Munich Bayerischer Hof Hotel. What might be discussed is ongoing Munich Security Conference delegate military support for genocide in the Middle East, and it is to the shadow of a NATO nation war on Iran that we turn to. Iran has already said it will shut down the choke point of world trade, the Strait of Hormuz, less than 100 miles away from this studio. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is someone who was a top Iran advisor to the U.S. government up until a couple of years ago. Alan Ayer was the senior advisor for Iran at the U.S. State Department. He's a 40-year U.S. government official who was on the U.S. JCPOA nuclear negotiating team and the first Persian language spokesperson at the U.S. State Department. He's now a distinguished diplomatic fellow at the Middle East Institute. Alan, thanks so much for coming on Going Underground. Monday seems a long time ago, you know. The Gulf News in Dubai, UAE welcomes US-Iran talks, calls for peace, of course, across this region. By the time this is broadcast, we don't know. Perhaps the war will have already begun. What do you think? Trump is frightened of Iran and Israel, perhaps via Jeffrey Epstein?
No, I don't think fear is the dominant motivation behind this administration's actions. I do agree that there seems to be a real fundamental ambiguity and uncertainty as to what they're trying to get out of this. You know, there's strategic ambiguity. There's also strategic inconsistency. And I think the U.S. administration has done more of the latter than the former. We don't know if President Trump is trying to merely limit Iran's nuclear program. Its nuclear missile program, its missile program, its support to proxies, or is in fact trying to encourage regime change. So it's
Well, we kind of do know, don't we? We do know, because he wanted those negotiations to center not just on the civil nuclear, military nuclear, which doesn't exist, arguably, but we'll get on to that, and ballistic missile program.
That's it. That was his latest utterance. He said, we want to do the nuclear, we want to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons, which has been the goal of every U.S. administration. It's just that the tactics have changed. He said, we want to do the missiles, we want to do this, we want to do that. So he really wasn't speaking with clarity. I don't know to what extent that was intentional. But yeah, it does seem to be the consensus based on what others, to include Secretary of State Rubio, have said, that because the U.S. senses that Iran is historically weak, it thinks it can get a far better deal that includes not just no indigenous enrichment of uranium, no stockpiles of uranium, but also severe limitations on both the range and the number of Iranian missiles and support for proxies, which is, of course, the de minimis that Israel is looking for. And that's why there's constant communication between Israel and the United States on the Iran portfolio.
And of course, Iran says all that is completely out of the question as to negotiations. And I'm not sure where Marco Rubio is getting that information from. Maybe you can tell me how you assess your old workplace, the State Department, as regards intelligence, because China seems to have come in to support the currency in Iran, which Mossad was tweeting about, apparently, and certainly Scott Bessant was saying on the Hill that it was all the Americans that were behind the protests. Where do you think they're getting this information that Iran is in desperate straits, especially after the show of force celebrating the anniversary of the revolution in 1979 this week?
Well, yeah, they celebrated the revolution, but so what? They do that every year. I think Iran is historically weak in the sense that the traditional pillars of its strategic deterrence are gone. And here I would have to go against what you said. China and Russia are not coming to Iran's aid militarily or economically. you know, the exchange rate was at 150, was it 1.5 million reals to the dollar, right? They're having rolling blackouts. There's water shortages. So Iran is not looking and should not look for economic salvation from any country because it's not going to get it. So Iran is very weak, but paradoxically, I think Iran is in many ways, as you alluded to, too weak to negotiate because it senses that any concessions beyond the minimal concessions it's willing to give, which is we will accept limitations on the amount of enrichment we do and the stockpile of enriched uranium in exchange for lessened sanctions. Anything beyond that, I think Iran feels would be chum in the water, attracting the sharks and attracting further aggression. Because don't forget, in Iran's mind, Israel is after regime change. And the U.S., if it can get it.
Not in Iran's mind, yeah. I think everyone's mind. And surely it has strategic deterrence because it has the hypersonic missiles. And we know earlier in the month, Israel apparently said, do not attack Iran to the Trump administration because they weren't ready for the largest stockpile of hypersonic missiles in this region. I mean, where are you getting all of that? It has the strategic deterrence and economically, arguably, it might not be able to survive without China and Russia help, which is being given as a member of BRICS. It is, of course, a member of BRICS like the UAE is.
Well, if China and Russia are giving economic help to Iran, they're doing a horrible job. Just look at any statistic of the Iranian economy, and you'll see it's on life support. In terms of strategic deterrence, of course, they've got about 2,000
Sorry to interrupt there, Alan, but I mean, you were at the State Department, and you know that's the kind of thing that they used to say about Cuba over the, how many years has it been, that embargo? I think it's tough in Cuba right now, I'll tell you that. But you're saying it's on life support, the economy. Where is this intel coming from, but the regurgitated false evidence of imminent regime collapse that it was that presumably Netanyahu speaks of?
Please don't put words in my mouth. I'm not saying imminent regime collapse because there's not necessarily a historic connection between economic deprivation and regime fragility, especially in a country like Iran, where you've got a state that has very powerful tools of coercion, as we saw in the recent protests. I'm just saying that by all conventional measures, the Iranian economy is doing very badly. It's got negative GDP growth. Now, the fact that the U.S. government is saying that, and the U.S. government in this administration at least often says things that aren't true, doesn't mean that's not true. So again, we can go round and round about how good or how bad the Iranian economy is, but certainly it seems to be the case anecdotally, since that's what caused initially the December 28th protests. And that's what's caused, I think, 3 out of the last 4 major protests in Iran, that a large number of the Iranian people feel that the regime or the government is not doing a good job getting them essential goods and services at a price they're comfortable with.
The Trump administration and the United States, because Scott Bessant testified that it was the Americans that are behind the misery and evisceration of the economy in the first place. But I mean, actually coming onto that subject, since you were a negotiator, why did Iran not get the sanctions relief that they had been promised under JCPOA? You negotiated under the Obama administration. Why is it that that end of the bargain was never, I mean, some might say Iran was idiotic for negotiating JCPOA at all and trusting NATO nation powers. Why was there no sanctions relief?
There was significant sanctions relief. If you look at the roughly 2 years where Iran was functioning economically under the JCPOA, the economy did a lot better than before. Of course, then we pulled out. Now, they still have structural economic problems.
Well, they were under sanctions.
Yeah, but not the sanctions that we negotiated to remove under the JCPOA, not the UN sanctions. Yeah, there's a multiplicity of sanctions. And I concur with your earlier assessment that U.S. sanctions have done real damage to the people of Iran and have been contributing and been a major factor in the poor performance of the Iranian economy. It's not the only reason, but obviously U.S. and Western sanctions against Iran have played a key role in weakening the Iranian economy. The Supreme Leader gets that, which is why he's always agitating for what's called a resistance economy or a self-sufficient economy. But let me tie a bow on your earlier comment. Yeah, they still do have deterrence. They've got about 2,000 missiles that can reach a variety of targets. They can cause a lot of pain and destruction in the region. So when I say their strategic deterrence triad has been weakened, I mean their nuclear infrastructure's been decimated, their proxy network has been weakened, and they lost about a third of their missiles that could reach targets they care about. They still do have a substantial deterrent capability, which is one of the reasons why the U.S. allies in the region, like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, are lobbying hard with the United States for there to be no military action, because they know the negative consequences of Iranian military action.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I should ask you whether you think, after all these years, that clearly Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa against nuclear weapons was a grave mistake for the Islamic Republic. I mean, if you were advising Pezeshkian and you were on the, you know, some people say there's no such thing as a supreme leader in Iran. He's answerable to the Assembly of Experts. You're an expert. If you were on the Assembly of Experts, what would you be saying to Khamenei about that fatwa? And surely many people, and it's already in the Iranian parliament, MPs have been talking about it there. Now is the time to use the 400 kilos of enriched uranium that somehow disappeared in the 12-day war to create a nuclear weapon, because that's their only real deterrent.
Well, first of all, any fatwa issued by the late Ayatollah Khomeini doesn't count anymore, because once the person who issues the fatwa dies, it's null and void. Now, Khomeini, even though some would argue he lacks the essential religious learning, has issued a similar fatwa saying, you know, we're against their haram, weapons of mass destruction. But here's the key point. Iran is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Being a member, a signatory of the NPT, has both rights and responsibilities. Iran is very keen on preserving what it perceives as its rights under the NPT, but it's been less adamant and successful about fulfilling its responsibilities. And the entity that determines whether Iran is fulfilling its NPT obligations isn't Ayatollah Khamenei. It's the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which functions under the cover of the NPT and says which countries are and are not living up to their NPT obligations. And they have said repeatedly, Iran isn't. So while it's all well and good that Iran can say, we have a fatwa prescribing nuclear weapons, that doesn't count. And secondly, as close advisors to the Supreme Leader has said, they can change that anytime. You know, they can say, well, now it's in our interest to have a nuclear weapon because other countries have it and we need it to preserve our existence. Now, you can argue as to whether it would be a good idea strategically for Iran to seek a nuclear weapon. I would argue it's not, especially given that the eyes of the world, of the West, of Israel, the U.S., are on Iran's nuclear program right now, ready to respond kinetically if they see an Iranian effort to either rebuild its nuclear program or to make a nuclear weapon.
Alan Eyre, I'll stop you there. More from the U.S. State Department's former senior advisor for Iran after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the U.S. State Department's former senior advisor for Iran and core member of the U.S. JCPOA nuclear negotiating team, Alan Eyre. Alan, you were telling me about Iran's responsibilities under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Clear, after the revelations about IAEA subterfuge, spies apparently in the IAEA, it's idiotic for Iran to be, arguably, in the NPT at all. You were saying it's not sensible for them to obtain a nuclear weapon. Given you're an expert on these things, how long would it take for those 440 kilos of enriched uranium, highly enriched uranium, to be turned into a nuclear weapon to end war, some might say, in this region, or the chances of war, because that would represent a deterrent?
Well, first of all, to state the obvious, I'm against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. I think that to the extent that any new country gets a nuclear weapon, the chance of nuclear weapons being used increases. And I also think, to be fair...
But do you think Trump has encouraged it? Do you think Trump has encouraged it? Proliferation.
Let me finish one. And I also think those countries who have nuclear weapons, such as the United States, have a responsibility under the NPT to decrease their arsenal and move toward a world without nuclear weapons. So I think the risk of unintentional proliferation and the consequences are terrifying. So I think Iran pulling out of the NPT would not be a good idea. I think that Iran seeking a nuclear weapon as a means of deterrence would not be a good idea.
Really? That's what you'd say if you were advising them? Because Israel has nuclear weapons. We had the source of Cy Hirsch's The Samson Option on the show. Ari Ben-Menashe, who used to work in Israeli intelligence, who's now talking about Epstein blackmail against Trump. And he said, clearly, there's a nuclear doctrine for Israel. I mean, what was it like being a U.S. negotiator for JCPOA, knowing full well that Israel had nuclear weapons, and it would only enforce some kind of detente for Iran to have them to prevent a war in this region?
Yeah, obviously, I'm not going to defend Israel's covert weapons program. They're not an NPT member, so they, unlike Iran, are not in violation of any responsibilities they signed up to as a signatory of the NPT. Having said that, as I said earlier, I'm in favor of no country having nuclear weapons, of having the Middle East being a nuclear-free weapon zone. I would also point out that, yeah, Israel does have nuclear weapons, and how's that working for it? Did that stop the Hamas attack? Did that stop all the other wars that it's engaged in? So there's an argument to be made that actually having a nuclear weapon doesn't do much, or at least all that it's supposed to do, in terms of deterring aggression against the country that has it. So, again, were I advising Iran, I would advise Iran to accept limitations on its nuclear program and to accept IAEA inspections, because if you look at the amount of economic damage Iran has suffered as a result of its nuclear program, Iran's nuclear program gives them 1% of all the power they use in the country.
Yes, some might say look at Cuba and Venezuela. They don't have nuclear weapons. It just depends on who the United States doesn't like. It doesn't matter. The nuclear program is just an excuse. But actually, on proliferation, Hussein Kanani, the ex-IRGC commander, he spoke to a former CNN presenter, now presenter of RT's The Sanchez Effect. And Hussein Kanani said, "We've got solid intelligence that Saudi Arabia has a nuclear bomb and the U.S. and Israel are fully aware of it." When you were a U.S. negotiator for Obama, did you ever hear that Saudi Arabia had nuclear weapons?
I'm not going to disclose classified information I may have heard or not heard, but I've never heard that. You know, I find that not believable, that Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons. It's quite possible that they have, due to their relationship with Pakistan, some type of deal where they're under Pakistan's nuclear umbrella, but I don't think Saudi has their own nuclear weapons.
Did it alarm you when you heard about the 4.2 Richter scale 9 a.m. Dimona earthquake on the 15th of January? What do you think? Do you think that conceivable that Netanyahu is testing new nuclear weapons at Dimona?
I mean, I think anything's conceivable. I think it's unlikely.
Because tremors...
It's pretty hard to hide nuclear test explosions where you actually explode a nuclear weapon. You can do computer simulations, and that's what some countries are moving toward. But there's a lot of entities in the world who would detect that and make a big deal of it. And that didn't happen. So while you can never rule out something, I find that unlikely.
What was it like when you were a negotiator at the State Department? I mean, you worked for, you were a senior advisor on Iran for Antony Blinken, I understand. Did you feel the pressure of the so-called
No, I was, during the Obama administration, I was a subject matter expert on Iran for the nuclear negotiating team, both when it was headed by Bill Burns and then by Wendy Sherman. I was also the Persian language spokesperson. I really didn't focus on Iran during the Biden administration. At that point, I was in Jordan doing something else. So what was it like being a negotiator? It was enjoyable in the sense that you were doing important work. You were working with incredibly experienced, impressive people. Wendy Sherman is the single most impressive diplomat I've ever encountered. It was a hard job. The Iranians
did you, you're speaking Wendy Sherman. Did you feel the pressure of the Israel lobby when you were working in Jordan under the Biden administration? Anthony Blinken comes up because he's the stepson of Robert Maxwell's personal lawyer. And of course, Robert Maxwell's daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, very much dominating, or certainly her associate, Jeffrey Epstein, dominating the headlines in your country more than conditions here in the Middle East. Did you feel the power of the Israel lobby?
I mean, I felt the influence of not just the Israel lobby, but all the allies of the United States. No one's going to deny the incredibly strong strategic relationship between Israel and the United States. Additionally, certainly with this administration, the Trump administration, the Gulf countries, to include Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, they also have a large influence on President Trump and this administration. So, you know, that's the part and parcel of being a country like the United States that has a lot of allies of greater and lesser intensity, is that they get to chime in as to what they think you should do. And we have to listen. So, I mean, that's just part of the, you know, it's part of the game. I mean, part of the negotiations was not just other countries, but it was different entities within the United States with different opinions in terms of what they thought was the optimal course of action. So it was a very complicated process.
I'm in the Abu Dhabi National here.
Senior, and different in the negotiations going on now, but go ahead.
Yes, senior UAE diplomat visits Iran as fears of U.S. action persist. Who has more power in that relationship? All that Miriam Adelson money going into Trump's coffers, the threat of Epstein blackmail versus the power of GCC countries trying to persuade Trump not to attack.
Yeah, obviously there's, I would characterize it differently, but obviously President Trump is, among other things, is a shrewd politician, and he's got a variety of both domestic and foreign factors he's weighing when deciding what to do next. To me, you know, the ultimate question is, what advances American interests? You know, what's the best thing for the U.S. to do? But I'm not going to deny that there's domestic political considerations. As former House Speaker Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. So, yeah, politics is a huge part of U.S. foreign policy.
I mean, given Israel's stock has never been lower after what's been happening, what they've done to the men, women, and children of Gaza, and given that Iran is a member of BRICS, as I said, is this Israel's last chance to annihilate what it's always wanted to annihilate? Is that what Netanyahu and members of his cabinet are feeling right now?
Again, I don't have a lot of granularity on the thinking inside Prime Minister Netanyahu's cabinet. There is definitely a feeling that for Israel, unlike the United States, Iran is an existential threat, or perceives Iran to be an existential threat. And whereas President Trump could well be satisfied with a good deal on the nuclear issue, Israel seems to be dedicated to the proposition that the Islamic Republic in and of itself is unacceptable for Israel. So limitations on nuclear would not be enough. Limitations on missile and proxies would not be enough. They feel that as long as Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is a functioning state that can project power, Israel is under threat, which is why, yeah, I agree with you. I think Israel's goal, or at least a part of the cabinet, is to so weaken this regime that it's unable to project any type of power that could threaten Israel.
Clearly, militarily, Russia and China, apart from supplying weapons, are not going to get involved kinetically. But and the GCC countries are not militarily capable enough. What is your view as to how Turkey will respond to a U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran? NATO member Turkey, Turkey.
I mean, Iran's overriding strategic reality is they're on their own. They learned this during the 8-year Iran-Iraq war. Yeah, they get some diplomatic succor and support from Russia and China. But as I said earlier, they're quite aware of the fact that both those countries would throw Iran under the bus.
But you don't see things have changed since your time when you were a JCPOA negotiator, since the war in Western Europe, as all these other powers, and in relation to even the kidnapping of Maduro and Celia Flores in Venezuela. We live in a new world now where the United States is seen as a rogue nation.
It's changed substantially. And for example, Russia cooperated with us maximally during the JCPOA. They were a strong ally. Such cooperation now, I think, is quite unlikely. And yes, this current U.S. administration, the Trump administration, doesn't believe in multilateral action, doesn't believe in concerted cooperation with the allies. They tend to do things unilaterally. They tend to do things they see transactionally. So yeah, obviously, you know, the international scene, the international scenario is quite different than it was in the Obama administration or in the Biden administration.
Can I just very quickly, yes or no, would you advise Trump to go use the USS Abraham Lincoln or not if you were right now in the State Department? Would you tell Rubio, don't do this or do this?
I would advise any U.S. official right now not to use military action against Iran because you're not going to get what you want, right? There are better ways to do it. If it can be done at all, it could well be the case that there is no good outcome because the situation bilaterally has been so soured between the two countries, right? So it's, don't think that there's a magic solution that can fix this problem. There isn't. It's too late for that. But you can avoid worst case scenarios, and that's something I think should be done, and that involves not using military force against Iran.
Alan Eyre, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of US-UK EU armed bombing of Gaza and attempts on Iran. We'll be back on Monday with an ex-CIA officer who blew the whistle and publicly shamed CIA bosses for how they manipulated intelligence. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.